Hey, it's Brent Smith, and welcome to BSL Insider Radio. And today, I'm very excited to have a special guest, Dr. Edna Foa. She's a professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Center for the Treatment and Study of Anxiety. She received a PhD in clinical psychology and personality from University of Missouri, Columbia in 1970, and she's devoted her academic career to the study and psychopathology and treatment of anxiety disorders, primarily obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and social phobia, and is currently one of the world's leading experts in these areas. She's also one of Time Magazine's most 100 influential people, and she's developed a breakthrough therapy for PTSD that has been successfully adopted by the U.S. Army, and we'll let her explain exactly what that is. But welcome, Dr. Foa.
Thank you very much for inviting me and having me on your program.
Well, thanks.
Great.
We're really excited to have you here. And why don't you just start, you know, talking about PTSD, because it's something that obviously is really taken over and it's such a big discussion going on across the globe.
Yeah. So post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder that has been known for generations, but it really was introduced into as a formal anxiety disorder into the manual of psychiatric disorders only in 1980. As a result of people coming from Vietnam and the realization that the symptoms that they have from combat, in many of them, they don't go away. They stay for years and years and years. So the symptoms of PTSD are intrusive thoughts about the traumatic event, flashback about the traumatic event, nightmares, avoiding situations and thoughts that remind them of the traumatic event, difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating. And so this is actually a difficult and problematic disorder. It's also a disorder that influences the entire scope of life in people. It influences relationship, it influences ability to work and the ability to stay in jobs or to find jobs, the irritability. A lot of people with PTSD find themselves divorcing their wives, getting estranged from the families, and so we really need to find treatments that work for these people, because it's not just the symptoms; it's all their life is influenced and affected by PTSD. Now,
right,
with the wars, the two wars that we had in the last 10 years, with the growing of terrorism around the world in the United States. I mean, we just witnessed this in Boston last week.
Yes.
There is a growing number of people with PTSD. I want to say that not everybody that experiences trauma is going to develop chronic PTSD. In fact, the majority of people have symptoms in the beginning, and the symptoms may last 2 or 3 months, 4 months, and then they kind of decline in severity and frequency. And maybe for many people they don't completely go away, but most people recover in the sense that they go back to functional life. And that if they even have symptoms, they're not that distressing and impairing. But up to 20% of people who have gone through a traumatic event, especially rape and combat. These people will have chronic PTSD, and once you have chronic PTSD, once you have PTSD for a year, it would stay there forever unless the person gets an effective treatment. So now, I mean, just to give numbers, the RAND Corporation is estimating that at this point, just from the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, there are 300,000 to 400,000 people, veterans or active duty personnel, that are suffering from PTSD. That's beside all the people that are suffering from PTSD, from accidents, from earthquakes, rape, sexual abuse, etc. So the numbers are actually staggering.
Yes. So maybe you can talk about, you know, kind of what you've come up with at this point and really talk about, you know, how people have been traditionally handling PTSD. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Or how people, how people have been traditionally treating it.
So traditionally, people were treating PTSD with a variety of treatments, hypnotherapy, psychotherapy, psychodynamics, psychotherapy, counseling, psychoanalysis. There are actually about 50 kind of therapies for PTSD that one of my research assistants counted when he looked into the literature. So, but all those treatments have no evidence that they actually work. And some of them have evidence that they work less well than other treatments. So the only treatments that actually do have evidence that they work, and when I talk about evidence that they work, I'm talking about studies that compare those treatments to people that didn't get treatment or people that got medication or people that got counseling, and that these evidence-based treatments are doing are helping in improving these problems of PTSD more than those comparisons. So it could be that psychodynamic psychotherapy works, but we don't know whether or not that it works because there were no studies that were done to actually examine in a scientific way whether this treatment work. The other thing that is important is that because of the staggering number of people with PTSD that need treatment, we need to have treatments that are not just effective but also efficient. And so with this consideration in mind, I develop a treatment starting 20 years ago, but it continues to be developed, continues to be studied. We try to make the treatment more and more efficient, more effective, and this treatment is called prolonged exposure. Now, what is prolonged exposure? Prolonged exposure is based on emotional processing theory that said that the reason why people maintain anxiety disorders in general and PTSD in particular is that people avoid thinking about the trauma and avoid going to places that remind them of the trauma. So what does it mean? It means that, you know, people have intrusive thoughts or flashbacks or a physiological response like heart rate beating fast when they are reminded of the trauma. That's painful and distressing. So obviously people try to reduce the distress, and they do it by avoiding. So if for example, they have a thought about the fact that they were raped, or a thought about what happened in a particular event, battle in Iraq, they try to push it away, not to think about it, to think about something else, to distract themselves. And what happened when they distract themselves and they don't allow themselves to think about the traumatic event is that they are preventing themselves from digesting and processing the trauma, the memory. So the memories get kind of stuck in what we call working memory. Instead, after you process an event, then the event can move from the working memory into long-term memory. And then it resides in the long-term memory, and you can retrieve it from the long-term memory, but it doesn't haunt you all the time. If you don't process and you don't digest the traumatic memory, then it continues to haunt you. The other thing that happens to people with PTSD is they don't go to places that remind them of the trauma or places that they think are similar to where the trauma happened, and so they avoid it because they don't want a repetition of the trauma. For example, many servicemen, soldiers who come from Iraq and Afghanistan avoid going on highways because the highways in Iraq were dangerous. I mean, you have IEDs, you had attacks. So they come to Iowa or they came to Pennsylvania and they generalize, and now they don't drive on highway. Or if they see a trash can, they get very frightened and they immediately kind of get away from it because maybe there is a bomb hiding there. People with PTSD don't go to public places, they don't go to crowded places because who knows, who is there in the crowd, and they may be in danger. So they don't go to supermarkets, they don't go to movies, they don't go to restaurants, and their life gets very restricted and very impaired. Now, if avoidance is maintaining the PTSD symptoms, then it's very reasonable and logical to say, well, how can we overcome PTSD? We overcome it by doing the opposite, by helping people not avoid, but approach the things that they're afraid of, but not approach things that are really dangerous, but approach situations that are in reality safe, like supermarkets, like restaurants. But they think that the situation is dangerous. So what happens when we make a list of situations that they avoid? And the situations are situations that we all go to, situations that we all think are safe, and we start with situations that they are not so afraid of, and we go on to situations to higher and higher and situations that are more and more fearful to them. And what do they find? They find out two things. One is that nobody attacked them, and the other thing that they didn't fall apart as they thought that they will, because they are weak and they cannot handle their anxiety and their symptoms. That's one technique, we call it in vivo exposure, that we are using. The other technique we are calling imaginal exposure, which is actually we ask the patient to invite the traumatic memory, and that form invite memory and then tell the memory, talk about it. Usually we ask them to close their eyes so they can really concentrate on what happened there and tell us what happened in as many details as they can. And what happened when they do it, and they don't do it once, they do it many times because the treatment is about 10 sessions. So, and also we tape, audio tape, narrative, and then we ask them to listen to it also at home. And what happened so many times is that what they think happened was not accurate. So, for example, a soldier, after they, comes and say, well, his best friend was killed in battle when both of them, and he says, well, I could have saved him and I didn't. When he's imagining what happened, he's now finding out that he was so far away, from his friend when the battle was there, that there was no way he could have saved him. And then we talk about, what did he learn from this experience of revisiting the traumatic event, and you come to the conclusion that actually he couldn't do any more than he did. And then the feeling of incompetence, the feeling of guilt, the feeling of shame go away. Also, they find out that they don't have to avoid thinking about the trauma because now after talking about it again and again and listening to it, the distress goes down. They kind of habituate. It's like, if you see a horror movie the first time, of course you're scared. If you see the same horror movie 15 times, you're kind of bored.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened in the imaginary exposure, in the revisiting. So not only they kind of get used to it, they also kind of realize, well, it's not happening now. I'm talking about something that happened in the past, and that's not dangerous. It was dangerous to be in the traumatic event, but it's not dangerous to talk about it. So now they feel that they don't really need to avoid the process of the traumatic event. Now he's in kind of going into the long-term memories, and doesn't haunt them anymore. And they started to go to places, and they reclaim their life. So that's kind of in so many words the treatment that we are doing.
It's fascinating to me, based on all the traditional methods out there, and even how you came upon it. It's when you explain it, it sounds simple. Well, especially since it's a lot of the same things that I teach in my practices about story and reframing situations, and there's always what happens, and there's a story you tell about what happened, and the avoidance and denial and not living in the present and feeling that you're not in control of your memories and that you're actually the victim of them, and because that's how you've been programmed, that everybody's like that. The whole discussion is fascinating to me because it touches on so many things that we agree with. And another interesting thing is how you came upon your theory when you started to initiate your theory is that you weren't even thinking in terms of PTSD and pathology. It was more of a general thought, I'm told.
Yeah, it's true. It really was in 1980, and I was on sabbatical in England. And when you're on sabbatical, you have time to get ideas. And I thought, it's very interesting that we are never haunted by good memories. That means, you know, we don't, you know, relive and re-experience and have flashbacks about the day that we got married, even though it was a wonderful day. So, you know, we do remember it, but it doesn't haunt us. Right? It does not coming every day or five times a day. And you know, but with traumatic memories or bad memories, they do haunt us. And we come back to think about them. And so I was thinking, you know, why is it? And how do people actually recover? And why some people recover and other people don't recover from traumatic experiences? And so my questions in the beginning were theoretical questions. But once I started to, and I started my work with rape victims, because I thought, well, nobody compensates them, and so I will get a more accurate story from them. And once I saw how much they suffer, I felt that there is a need to develop a treatment, an effective and short-term treatment for them. And that was in 1980, and that was just the year that PTSD was invented. The concept was invented. So I didn't know that I was talking about PTSD. I was just talking about trauma.
Trauma.
Traumatic events, yep. Or bad events, or difficult events.
It's amazing that your treatment, it works so fast. And is so effective and so efficient. Efficiency, I guess, is maybe the key word there. But and I love that about it, because it really is the question: why do some people recover? Why do some people with incredibly traumatic backgrounds, sometimes become some of the most productive members of society? And sometimes the opposite is true of people who have a perfect life and they become destructive. So it's really interesting to me to ask those questions and about why the bad memories would haunt you more than the good memories, and how much of that is a natural occurring thing and how much of that is preconditioning to the traumatic event. So
it's difficult to say, you know, but you can. It's reasonable from the evolutionary point of view that you don't want to forget bad things, because if you remember them, it may help you.
Right, may help you survive.
Survive, yes. Right? But if you remember them too much, like people with PTSD. Then your ability to function is impaired, right? And so what can be evolutionary advantageous if it's in moderation, right, become disadvantageous if it's become a disorder, a psychopathology, if you start to be afraid of everything in the world.
Yeah, everything and everything that reminds you of the situation that actually isn't that way.
That's right. I mean, it's good to be afraid of guns, but it's not good to be afraid of highways in Iowa.
That's true, and it impairs your everyday life.
Or not to go to the supermarket, or not to go to restaurants. Or not to go in any crowded places.
Well, and that could be said about a lot of things that have happened to people in life that some would call traumatic and others would call untraumatic, whether it's a childhood experience or whether it's just being rejected by someone you like, you know, or being devastated by some. And every time you think about that situation or go into a place like that or hear a song, or you get the same feelings come up.
And some people are more resilient and some people are more vulnerable from the beginning. I mean, we do know that avoidance maintains anxiety symptoms and PTSD symptoms. But why do some people avoid and others do not? You know, that's another question, right? That's a question of, you know, high sensitivity to distress. Some people are very sensitive to anxiety, and anxiety is very aversive for them, so they will do anything to not be anxious.
I have a question for you. Is there currently any pre-treatment or pre-trauma exercise or, I don't want to say even treatment, but program that people can go through prior to experiencing trauma, possibly, that would cause them to be more resilient than those who are less resilient?
Well, in the Army, in the military, you have programs like this. I mean, people are exposed to, you know, all kind of events through movies, through videos, and, you know, they do exercises simulate, I wouldn't say traumatic event, but difficult event. How helpful are those to prevent PTSD? We don't know.
So there's nothing that, no studies that have been done on that.
No, studies are being done, but they are not yet, they are being done now, but we don't yet have results from them.
Wow, that fascinates me, because I love to explore the cause of things as well and create programs for that. Jason, you want to jump in here at all?
Yeah, I mean, another thing, too, I think is fascinating is how people give meaning to things and meaning to things that have no meaning. And I think going through, kind of what you've developed at that point, they've sort of got a new perspective on that. Mm-hmm. And also just it's interesting to me how memories, how people don't really remember what happened, and they've created this whole other reality in their mind.
Story.
And the fact is once they start to actually get to the point where they're back in the moment and reliving it, and it's necessary to be emotionally connected to that. You can't just do it as like a bystander, that how you actually can see the truth of what actually went on. And I'd just love for you to touch on that, because that's another thing that Brent and I have talked about, is just fascinating, and how we find that people have dramatic breakthroughs by getting, by those concepts.
Because, yeah, you're right. People have misconceptions. About the meaning of what happened to them. And you can address it by just talking about it, right? And kind of to try to convince them their thinking is dysfunctional or erroneous. But actually going into their imagination and imagine what happened, and have not just imagine what happened, but what they were thinking at the time, what they were feeling at the time, what happened at the time, and get emotional about it, is giving them a window to information that they wouldn't have otherwise. That just talking about it in the abstract would not bring in. So the image of the soldier, that he was far away from his friend, and he didn't even think about how far he was. He just thought that he should have saved him. And that's, this was like a rumination on I should have saved him. Right? And since he did not allow himself to go into the image, right, and into thinking about it, he didn't have the information that he was not able to save him. And that's just, I have so many stories like this, another soldier that, he's in a tank and he's in the, belly of the tank, and the tank is caught in fire. And so he's trying to get out by pushing up, and trying to get out from, and his commando is sitting on the top of the tank. So, with a lot of effort, he managed to pull the commando into the belly of the tank, and then he gets out. And this, all these years, 20 years, he's thinking that he killed the commando by pushing him in and getting out because, the tank was caught in fire. Well, when he got into prolonged exposure, or PE, and he started to imagine minute by minute what happened, he realized that if the commando was alive, because this was, in the middle of a battle, right? If the commando was alive, he would have jumped off the tank. He wouldn't stay sitting on a tank that is in fire. So then, and he also realized that when he pulled him in, he felt very heavy, like dead people feel. And so all of a sudden he realized I didn't kill him. He was dead.
Mm.
And that was, kind of a revelation for him and a freedom.
Yes.
And he wouldn't get this if he wasn't going into the imagery.
Yes.
Powerful. Visualizing, going back to it, creating, that's always what happened in the story that you tell about what happened. It's really strong, powerful.
Can you talk about, the other question I have is that, I know you mentioned, and I read stuff about power and control over your life and gaining control over that. And I'm just curious on, like, as people go through this therapy and they get more power and control over their life and realize that they're in charge of it, does this start, I guess it's maybe an anecdotal story, but is it just find people are gaining control over their entire life and kind of in some ways this setback actually can propel them forward by being able to kind of manage their entire life a lot better, being able to sort of process things this way?
Absolutely. And people are, are telling us, what happened to their life, spontaneously. For example, one of our patients, at the last session we asked them, tell us how the treatment helped you and, what did you get out of the treatment in general? And then, people said, well, I have become so close to my children. Before the treatment, I couldn't stand my children. Not that I didn't love them, but they were making noise, and the noise was just making me crazy and making me so irritable and angry that I always shouted at my wife, "Take the children away!" And when I was not anxious anymore and the traumatic memories didn't haunt me, and the anxiety went down, and I felt that here I am, I'm not the prisoner that I was, but a free person. Then their noise was fun, the children's noise rather than irritating.
Yes. Yeah.
So this kind of story, or people, just find a job. After 10 years of not working, because they could focus, they could concentrate, they could go to interviews without anxiety and appear competent, and they get a job. So not everything is resolved after PE. I don't want to, give the impression that, everything is, but many things are resolved.
Yeah. You can at least manage it. I think that's the thing, at least that some people are managing it, managing their anxiety and being able to deal with these things.
Well, become more functional, and it affects every part of their life and certainly important parts of their life, like their family.
Right, and even if, they need to solve more problems, they are in much better position.
Yes.
In psychologically, to actually problem solve what they need to change in their life.
Well, they have an emotional freedom now, and they believe that they can control their life and at least have control of their emotions rather than letting their emotions control them and being the victim of that.
That's right. That's what, you know, they see that, you know, and we also, you know, kind of present the treatment as if a person with PTSD is controlled by the traumatic memories. The traumatic memories dictate to them what to think and what not to think, where to go and where not to go. And you know, their life is really controlled by the traumatic memories. Well, once the memory is processed and once their perception of the world changes and now it's not a dangerous world, when the world can be dangerous sometimes, I mean, we will never tell a person with PTSD or any person that the world is always safe. It's not.
Right, right.
But the world is mostly safe. And sometimes
mostly safe, and those fears that you read that you told them, the fears, most of their fears are unrealistic fears.
That's right. The fears that are realistic, we are not touching. I mean, we don't want to reduce realistic fears. Realistic fears are helpful. It's only the unrealistic fears that we are, we're aiming to change.
Out of curiosity, what is kind of the future of this whole thing? What kind of like the next steps are you sort of looking at this point in PTSD?
I think right now our problem is dissemination and implementation, because we have the treatments, but there are a lot of barriers to dissemination and implementation. And right now I'm doing a very big study with the Army to look at how to overcome some of the barriers. Therapists are conservative. They learn to do a kind of therapy, psychodynamic psychotherapy or counseling, and they're comfortable with it. That's what they learn. And now to learn something new is effortful. And so they go to a workshop and they get enthusiastic, and you know, many of them are coming back and go back to what they used to do before. So how to change behaviors of therapists is a big barrier. It's a big challenge, and we think that, you know, workshop with consultation after that, with supervision, will give the therapist, you know, more incentive to actually use the new therapy in their practice. And once they use it with two or three patients and they see how well the patients were doing, that will motivate them to go on. But there are also barriers of systems. In some systems, like in the Army, a psychotherapist will see a patient once a month. The treatments that we develop require once weekly sessions. So the system where the therapist works also has to change to accommodate the new requirements of the new treatment. I mean, a treatment is cost effective because, yes, you have to do it once a week, but you're doing only for 10 sessions, and then you get a person that is that is functional again. And we have data to show that people after PE are using mental health in the VA, are using mental health services less than half of what they used before PE. So it is a burden to the system to provide psychotherapy every week rather than every month, because then you can see less patients. You know, every therapist can see very less. But it's only for a short period of time. So if you are looking at a year, you see the cost-effectiveness of it. If you're looking for a week, you don't see it. And so now I think our main challenge is to disseminate and implement what the evidence-based treatment that we've developed.
Wow. We share the same challenge because you just described the way that we are moving forward and we are teaching what we teach and how, yes, what you said I'm in full agreement with, how people are attached to traditional systems. They've got a lot of emotional and financial investment in those systems. It's got a lot of the mind share, and it is a challenge slash opportunity to have them sign on to a new system without consistent ongoing support and, of course, proper inspiration like clients doing well and so on. But you could say the same of people, too. People, the clients that we coach, coming from an old traditional system, an old way of thinking where they think they're powerless and they are the victim and they blame everyone for where they are and they don't take responsibility for their lives and they have a story about it and everything's bad. And we understand that they've been brainwashed by society in certain ways. And so it is a challenge to have them think of a new system without ongoing support and implementation. So it's an incredible effort and incredible thing that you're doing. And I think, like you said, it's only going to take time for them. And those are certainly some real challenges. But I also like what you said about how they think of it as unsustainable over a year. But if your program works faster, then we're not talking about a year. It's actually more efficient and over the long haul, very cost efficient. In fact, extremely cost efficient.
Exactly.
Yep. Out of curiosity, do you find that like this is a larger issue as well of people actually, you know, going through school and processing at that point? Because I'm just wondering, do younger people have as much resistance to implementing this therapy as people who've been doing it for a while?
I'm not sure that it's about younger or older. I think that it's what they learn in graduate school.
Yes.
And now
it's what they learn in grade school?
Graduate school.
Okay.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, more and more of at least, you know, the good schools are teaching cognitive behavioral therapy and evidence-based treatment. And if they get it early on in their education, they're more likely to use it.
That's true. Right. That makes complete sense. Sure, because you'd be assimilate it, and when you assimilate it, you kind of go with that way of thinking, the CBT way. So that makes sense.
Are people across the globe implement? I mean, I know that I've read about how like you've had some challenges in Israel implementing this, but I'm wondering, you know, kind of as far as PE is it taken off in any other, you know, countries outside the United States? Something that people are starting to adopt?
Very much in Australia.
Okay.
In England, in the Scandinavian countries, more in countries where there is social health system, where the health system can dictate we are not paying for non-evidence-based treatment. Then there is more, pressure from top down to use evidence-based treatment and to learn evidence-based treatment.
Gotcha. I've got a question too. When PE doesn't work for people, what are the main reasons on why that it doesn't work? Is it? I'm just curious to know if it's the you know, implementation of it by the practitioner or is it the patient, and kind of what have you found kind of as like top line reasons why?
So we don't have good predictors because 80 to 85% of patients who receive PE are doing well. Now, not all of them are symptom free, but 85% are getting clinically significant better. So it's difficult to find predictors because, you know, to find good predictors, you have to have more failures.
Yes.
Than we have. But I would say that homework, not doing the homework, not being on board, continue to avoid.
So not being committed to the process.
One important, right, not buying into the system and into the process. This is, you know, one major reason. And I think that some therapists are better in kind of being cheerleaders and motivating their patients to not avoid, and some people are more passive about it.
Got it. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I think we find the same thing, too, with a lot of our clients. It's just, you know, when you make that commitment, then success is there, and typically when you don't, then you stop doing things that really kind of help you get through your challenge and issue and problem that you're having and wanting to get past.
Well, so. And you have to push through your resistance in your old belief system and accept a new way of thinking, and in a lot of cases take a leap of faith.
Exactly.
Right? And try something new rather than, you know, because if the old way worked for you, the old way would work for you. that's the evidence right there. So if you tried everything... Go ahead.
But then we say, you know, why did you come to therapy? If, you know, if everything was fine the way you did it before.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
that's what we say all the time.
Maybe
why
you don't need
why are you here? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ah, how funny. That's so, it's ironic because it's exactly what we encounter as well. And so it's about commitment of the person. And as you said, it's also about, you know, some practitioners, therapists, coaches, whatever, are better facilitators and better at inspiring and motivating patients or clients to learn and want to move forward and commit to a process and follow it through with ongoing support and realize that there really is a light at the end of that tunnel if they will just accept a new way of thinking and a new story and reframe and take control of their life and take responsibility.
Yep. I've got one last question for you, and I just wanted to get your take on this. So I was looking through one of the articles, and it mentioned about, you know, how they're sort of gradually getting – over your fears or anxiety versus kind of just getting right to the core of it. And the example was, you know, people who are afraid of sitting in the front row of a movie theater, instead of just moving from the last row and slowly moving forward, just go immediately to the front row. And it seems to me like a lot about kind of PE is really kind of just going right to the front row on that. And I just wondered if you could address that and your thoughts.
Actually not. I mean, it's true about imaginal exposure, that we are asking people to imagine the memory that is most haunting them. Because if they can manage this, then they will generalize to other events that are less upsetting to them. But when we do the in vivo exposure, we do it gradually.
Okay.
So we start with things that are less fearful for them, and then when they feel comfortable with this situation and they realize that its situation is safe, nothing bad happened to them, then we go gradually to more and more difficult situations.
Okay. Well, great.
So we're not flooding people. You know, we are going with their pace, or taking into account to help them to kind of get them to support them, but not to flood them.
Got it.
With anxiety.
Okay, that's wonderful. Brent, do you have anything else that you want to?
I think we've covered most of it. I think it's a fascinating discussion about PTSD and anxiety disorder and so on. And I think that anyone and everyone listening can relate to it in some way, in some part of your life where you've had trauma, whether it maybe it's not as severe as some of the stuff that we're speaking of today, but it could be even like trauma. And, you know, these same kinds of concepts can be applied to your life. And Dr. Foa, is there a resource that people listening who maybe are suffering from PTSD or know someone who is, or anxiety disorder, is there a place that they can go or that you send people, or is there a website or anything that you would like to let people know about?
Well, you know, there is a book by Oxford University Press. There is about prolonged exposure, both for the patients and for the therapists. But ABCT, the American Association for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, has a list of therapies that are doing work on PTSD. ADAA, the Anxiety Disorder Society of America, also. And if they go to our website, the CTSA website, they will find a lot of information.
Okay, and that website was, again, your website?
If they go on and look at my name, Edna Foa, and they look at University of Pennsylvania, Department of Psychiatry, they will get to the website.
Okay, wonderful, right. Wonderful. That's great. And we can put that information on our website too, everyone, so we can let you know more information if you want to find out more about that. Well, Dr. Foa, thank you so much for being here today and giving us your very valuable time. I'm sure that it has helped a lot of people and maybe open some eyes to some people to get some help or at least understand it better. And like I said, whatever level of issues they might have, hopefully this helped them in some way.
Thank you very much for inviting me and allowing me to share with you this information.
Well, we will continue to share with you. I'm taking lots of notes and coming up with some very interesting ideas. So we'd like to further collaborate with you. So we'll be in touch. Would you be open to that?
I would be very happy. Yes, I would be very open to it.
Wonderful. Well, we look forward to further collaboration then, and we will be in touch about that. So, everyone, wait for that as well. Maybe there'll be a little collaboration here, and wouldn't that be exciting? That would be really exciting, actually. So, listen, go ahead.
But I just wanted to say goodbye.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. And I wanted to say to everyone, thank you for being here. Jason, thank you for being here as usual. And if you have further, if you want further information on what I'm up to, you can go to my website, smithlifestyle.com. And we'll talk to you all later.